Hey, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming for the second installment of the public lecture series for legal holidays. Last time we just talked a little bit about, we opened up a little bit with Moses Mendelssohn, and as the proverbial father of the Haskalah, we talked a little bit about his thought and his life, and we talked a little bit about how obviously the Haskalah has been seen in very negative terms by many parts of the firm world. A lot of that may have to do with what came after Mendelssohn. Some think that Mendelssohn was a very bifurcated figure. We talked a little bit about how his thought in some ways actually doesn't seem to be so bifurcated, but he probably did live with some sort of tension between the Western world and the world of Torah. So now I want to pivot a little bit to one of his disciples. So it's often seen that not just Mendelssohn, but really it was his disciples who perhaps went off the rails. But we'll see today is that that was not necessarily 100% true. Some of his disciples definitely abandoned tradition and even went towards Christianity, but certainly not all. But we'll see perhaps what was unique about this particular case. In general, it could be argued that the Haskalah was really centered about an encounter with new ideas, right? So take Mendelssohn as an example. He didn't at first necessarily pivot into an entirely different world per se, but it was really the ideas that people were beginning to grapple with. Can we learn, is there truth in the Western world? What can philosophy teach us? What can we gain from culture? And it was the Maskilim who actively went out and chose to encounter these new ideas and perhaps new world. But at a certain point, the way the world was going, political developments really made it necessary for everybody to face a little bit of a different world. And with the advent of educational reforms, not basically every Jew was really required to encounter new ideas, and education in general had to change. So the question that people had to deal with was, how do we reimagine education? How do we package education that responds to this tension between these new developments and the need to counter new ideas? So the person we're going to focus on today is a figure named Hertz Homburg, Natalia Hertz Homburg. He was a disciple of Mendelssohn. He was often seen as being one of the radical Maskilim. But the text that we're going to look at, we'll explore a little bit, will affirm that will affirm that he seemed to have a fairly traditional bent, but he did advocate for a little bit more of integration than perhaps would have been seen to be normal before. But he's an important figure in reimagining the world, Jewish education post the Enlightenment. So to understand where Homburg is coming from before we look at what he writes, we have to understand a little bit what the world of education was. So before the 18th century, before the time of Homburg, so if we go back even before the 15th century, so the idea of mass education was very uncommon. Something that is easy to forget, that the idea that everybody, the idea of public school and the like might seem like something that always existed, but really not. Those who were wealthy had tutors. If you were a girl, then you were far less likely to be educated, with very few exceptions, but really not a whole lot of education in general before the 15th century, except for the elite. It was with the coming of Protestantism and Martin Luther that education becomes a little more common for the masses, but more on a religious level. He established institutions called Musterschulen, which were meant to be religious schools. And even at this point, Certainly, the act of teaching pedagogy was not a profession. It was a very low income. Schools were chaotic. Teachers were held in low esteem. So education was not seen as a very noble enterprise at that point. Only done really as necessary for religious aims, but teachers were not, but those religious teachers were not held in the highest of esteem. There was a movement called Pietism in the 17th century, and part of that phenomenon argued that that literacy correlates with character, so an even greater emphasis comes on education. And a figure named Philip Jacob Spener begins to introduce things like frontal instruction and decorum in the classroom that are things that are more familiar today that made education a better enterprise and sort of raised the effectiveness of education. And his successor as well, so it was really the first to introduce secular studies to school. So before, everything was really about religious and religious instruction, but in addition to prayer and hymn singing and Bible and catechisms, there was reading, writing, arithmetic, and physical exercise. And there was an emphasis on a strong work ethic, but also recognition that students need free time. So this is where we start to see schools becoming moving in the direction that we recognize, and he also established an institution to train prospective teachers. So the idea that teachers need to be trained also is part of this movement in the 17th century as Pietism. So all of this was mostly Protestant, but in 1774, the empress in Austria, who was Catholic, her name was Maria Theresa. So she released a general school ordinance which required literacy between ages 6 through 13. So now kids who are that age have to go to school. They have to be able to read. Before this, people didn't even read the Bible. And in fact, many Catholic leaders believe that people shouldn't be able to read the Bible on their own, because then if you're able to read, then you're able to think on your own. So it was better for people to hear it from the priests and to hear it from the religious instructions and have it packaged that way instead of people being able to read it on their own. But now students are learning how to read read the Bible. And so even within Catholicism, there are mass schooling becomes more common, group instruction and training teachers. So education is going in that direction. Where this becomes relevant for the Jews is that 8 years later, in 1782, Joseph II in Austria extended the requirements of education to Jews. Before, it was really just to Catholics, but this becomes extended to Jews. So, if you look on, this is on the very last page of your packet. It's flip all the way to the back on page 8. He says, as is our goal to make the Jewish nation useful and serviceable to the state. This is why education was important, so people could be useful members of society, mainly through better education and enlightenment of its youth, as well as by directing them to sciences, the arts, and crafts. We hereby grant order, graciously, that the tolerated Jews, okay, so there is toleration, but but that comes with being contributing members of society. So Tari Jews may send their children to primary, Christian primary and secondary schools so that they have at least the opportunity to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. And although they do not have in our capital a real synagogue, we nonetheless allow them to establish for their children, and at their own expense, a school of their own, organized in a fashion of their own religion. So so at that point, so Jews were allowed to attend Christian schools, but Jews not only... on the one hand, they're required to provide an education, but it could be a Jewish school, could be someone on their own terms. So Jews are now required to go to school, and rabbis such as Rabbi Cheskel Landau, known as Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Mordechai Bennett, all sort of went along with this and were willing to work with the government to make that happen. Now, of course, that what changes at this point is that for those who, and I don't know how many Jewish kids were getting a yeshiva education at this point, but what this means is that anybody who's getting yeshiva education So that curriculum has to change a little bit. It can't just teach Gemara anymore. So you have to be teaching other subjects as well. So then there has to be a little bit of a thought as to, you know, what you're going to teach, because if you have a limited amount of time to teach Judaic studies, can't just focus on Gemara, which is you know where some rabbis would have clashed with this a little bit, that that just takes away time from learning Gemara. But one needs to think about how one would systematically present what kids need to know in order to have a proper Jewish education. One thing that was required by the state was an education in ethics. And they insisted that there be a textbook that goes along with it. So again, some rabbis felt like Gemara was enough and that's it. But they needed a textbook in ethics. And again, it didn't have to be Christian ethics. It could be a book, you know, Jewish book on ethics, but it had to have some sort of morals and ethics. So this is where Naftali Herz Homburg comes in. He lived from 1749 to 1841. He was born in Lieben, Bohemia. And he, over the course of time, became a respected pedagogue. And he came to Galicia under the direction of Joseph II to establish German Jewish schools that would meet the guidelines of the edict. So he wrote a letter to rabbis in the community explaining that the method of pedagogy needed to change, as well as sort of the content, so there need to be better trained teachers, but also, again, a more systematic introduction of Jewish concepts that will allow kids to be well-rounded in their understanding of Judaism. So he begs the rabbis for their confidence to establish schools, where he was probably more successful than other people who had suggested certain reforms, was that he was a little bit less harsh and assertive, but was sort of willing to work with Rabbanim. When it comes to the letters that he wrote, it's a little bit it's unknown what the responses were. There was another figure, Naftali Herz Wesley, who wrote a letter urging reform in education and introducing more worldliness. His letter was very harsh and was met with harshness, but we don't really know what happened with Homburg. In terms of rabbinic responses. So Homburg therefore wrote this. Putting all this together, there was a need for a textbook on ethics, and he felt like there was a need for a textbook also to systematically explain Jewish concepts. So he wrote a book called Imre Sefer. Imre Sefer is a fairly generic name for a sefer. It's fitting that he called it Imre Sefer. Or Imre Sefer means, you know, nice or beautiful words. It's particularly fitting that he named his book Imre Sefer because the bracha that Yaakov gives to Naftali, which is his name, invokes the word, the phrase Imre Sefer. But he wrote a catechism called Imre Sefer. Get into a second what's in it. But in order to pass government standards, it needed to be approved, and the government urged a revision of Imre Sefer into a book called B'nai Tzion. So B'nai Tzion ends up being the book that people learned. And in fact, you were required, in order to get a marriage license, you're required to pass an exam, asserting that you had some sort of moral and ethical education. So B'nai Tzion was the book that ended up being used for that. And that book has a haskama from Rabbi Mordechai Bennett, who I mentioned before. So he was the author of a sefer Har Hamor. He was the chief rabbi of Moravia, and a very respected rabbi at the time. So B'nai Tzion had the approbation of Rabbi Mordechai Bennett, but B'nai Tzion was really a shortened version of Imre Sefer. What we're going to look at today, though, is the original Imre Sefer, to see what Homburg really was advocating for. Imre Sefer was written in both German and Hebrew. And the utility of that, so, I mean, a lot of Jewish kids knew Hebrew, but like what we described that the Biur, the Moses Mendelssohn's commentary on the Torah, included German, not because more because he wanted to teach Jewish kids to read German because they only knew Hebrew, they didn't know German. So he thought they take the Chumash and translate to German so kids can learn how to learn German that way. So, so it could be that. It could be that one reason why Imrei Sefer was written in German as well was to practice for kids to practice learning German, but it's also possible that actually, if anything, that girls really knew more German than Hebrew. So maybe for girls, it was more necessary that it be in German. So Imrei Sefer was in two languages. It has two sections. One really focuses on the fundamentals of Judaism as a religion, and the second part focuses on morals and ethics, on what we would call Musar, because this is really that was the part that was required to meet the governmental standards was that there had to be a moral and ethical component to it. The religious part of it of the book focuses on the Yud Gimel Ikarim, articles of faith and belief, and then it goes a little bit into the history of humanity, into the history of the Jewish people, talks about the Ten Commandments and Chagim, so really touching on very fundamental things. And then there's the Musar part, which in some ways seems to, we'll see, somewhat resembles a typical Sefer Musar. But it does expand to a more universal discussion, which we'll come to a little bit. So that's where it seems to diverge. Imrei Sefer is very clearly written for children. It's not overly philosophical, so even though it has a lot of philosophical principles in it, things that, as we'll see, would be things that would be included in Rambam and Chovos HaLevavos, but it's explained in very simple terms. He uses language like Ve'ata de'ubanai, like, you know, learn my son, so he's, you know, so he's talking to them in a way that's similar to the way the Sefer Echinuch was addressed to children. It was meant to be a book for children to learn on Shabbos afternoon. So this also very clearly is meant to address to children. Unlike others, Sfarim, that are more complex, Imrei Sefer is really broken down into paragraphs and numbered, which maybe was a pedagogical tactic so that so it'd be easier for children to follow along. One thing I'll just mention that's interesting is that Homburg bases his discussion on the fundamentals of faith on the Yikarian. What's interesting, and I noted in the last lecture, is that Mendelssohn tried arguing that Judaism is not really much of a creed, but it's more about actions and doing the right thing. So is this Homburg being a little more from than Mendelssohn? So the answer might be no. It could be that Mendelssohn really was against coercive religious ideology. So at some point in Jerusalem, Mendelssohn says that thank God Maimonides wrote the 13 Articles of Faith, not the 13 Shackles of Faith. But it could be that Mendelssohn didn't necessarily have a problem with the existence of 13 Ikarim, but as long as they were persuasive and not coercive. Okay. So now let's really get into the meat of what's in the sefer. So we'll look on page 2. So it's important to note that that the book did have a haskama, it had an approbation. So this already suggests that, again, with the backdrop of the fact that some academics considered Homburg to be one of the more radical maskilim, he did have an approbation from a very very reputable rabbi, Rabbi Mordechai Benet. He says, "Koher ani achacham shalom hamefar reino rav hirtz Homburg megillah sefer hanote and Imrei Sefer." Mosad al ikar rosh emuna even apina v'sefer kulo machbadim mamtakim. Everything is beautiful and sweet. Kula divrei tzadikim, the words of the righteous. Kiloshono tedaber mishpat hanar umaseu beumuna libo noheg lechos b'chokma musar yachta b'yiras elokim. Right, has wisdom and fear of God together. So Mordechai Benet seems to think that everything in this book is totally acceptable and religiously compatible. So that's important to see from the beginning in evaluating the place of this book. Source 2. Kol echad mimenu chafetz lirot tov bimei chayav. Kol adam yitaveh liyot bari b'chol kochotav tamid limtzo mezonotam al gushav v'chol tzarchav v'libo chofshi mikol da'agav yegov. So everybody wants to be healthy, to have all their needs. So then he raises this question. So if everybody wants to be healthy, physically healthy, spiritually healthy, then why do people waste their bodies and destroy themselves? People do make all sorts of poor choices with their bodies. They become addicted. I don't want to say addicted, but they come used to drinking a lot and waste their lives away. And here you can we'll see a few places where you hear echoes of the Rambam, but the Rambam Hilchot talks about the importance of maintaining a healthy body and staying away from things that are destructive. So he begins this with an imperative to care for oneself both for spiritual benefit and for physical benefit. But he says, "Al tadamu b'nafshechem she'efshar lasik hatzachat ha'adam ba'olam hazeh v'olam habav mibli da davar musar v'chochma." Don't just assume that you can figure it out on your own, the proper way to act. Are you going to build a house without the proper foundations? And the like. K'mamar chachamenu lo am ha'aretz chasid. Saying in Pirkei Avot that somebody who is an ignoramus can't be pious. So he set this up to say, listen, you want to be successful in life, you want to be healthy, and you want to be vital, but you can't do this on your own. You need to learn in order to be able to do that. You need to learn what's right and what's wrong. So that's how he's setting up this book, that this book is necessary. Right, going along with what it was a government requirement to learn ethics, but he's trying to say, like, look, this is something that we really believe, that you have to you can't just figure it out, you have to learn it. Okay, so that's how he starts up his introduction. I just want to note also in his introduction that he talks about he mentions both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh as a foundation for the Jewish people. So some of the Maskilim were accused of kind of disregarding Rabbinic Judaism, and there's places where in their writings they would refer to Tefillin as Totafot, because Tefillin is Rabbinic name and Totafot is the Torah name, where Rosh Hashanah would be Yom HaZikaron, because that's a Torah name as opposed to Rosh Hashanah, which is a rabbinic name. But here in his introduction, also in sort of explaining what he's doing, he does mention he says so with all this, one needs to learn both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. So that's noting that's important for all a person's moral success. So that's dependent upon both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. He affirms the Torah Shebaal Peh, right? So he's not necessarily as radical as people make him out to be. And that's how he's going to base the rest of his instruction. Includes both. Includes both the ideal set out by what's in Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay, so I mentioned there are two parts. There's religion, and there's a part that deals mostly with the fundamentals of Jewish religion, and then a part that's more moral. And he bases this on the Yud-Gimel Ikarim. So if we look at source 4, on page 2, he says, "Well, Lam Unan Yisrael be prats over my kefesh Shoshasar should say Ikarim." There are 13 principles. Mehen ikarim shesecho ha'adam yachol limtso mitatam aidei ha'fakira. Mehen ikarim shemitatam no da'alanu aidei ha'kabalav emunah b'divrei Moshe nevim chachamim shekol divrei ha'emet. So there are 13 principles, again, very much based on Rambam. I don't think there's, I mean, as he goes through the principles, it's very clear that they correlate with the Rambam. But he very clearly affirms that the Gimel Ikarim are the most sound way to understand the core Jewish beliefs. Some of these, he says, can be argued and understood from the intellect, which people like the Rambam believe that belief in God could be understood from the intellect, but other principles obviously stem from revelation of the Torah. So I don't want to get too bogged down into the philosophical components here, but if you were to look at a couple of the Ikarim he mentions here, so he mentions the second Ikar that God is comprised of a whole and is not divided. So that's something that Homburg writes here. If you look by side with the Rambam says the exact same thing. So Homburg writes who etzem pashut she'eno mechubar mukav mechalkin po guf hadam shegam hu guf echad aval mechubar meivari. So, but God is not divided into parts the way perhaps a human body is. Same thing that the Rambam writes in the Gimel Karim, as they appear in the Parish Mishnayot, the lo kedavar ha'echad amur kashu mechalek achadim rabim. Right, God is not divisible. God is one whole part. Okay, if we look at the third ikar on the next page, ikar shlishi she'etzem Hashem barach eno guf, ein lo dmuta guf lo dmuta bo shum mikra mim kare haguf. Absolutely no body. God doesn't have any of the five senses. Same thing with the Rambam. God has nothing physical to him. Okay, God doesn't move. God doesn't rest. A lot of parallels between Homburg and the Rambam. The fourth ikar that nothing precedes God. Nothing comes after God. So the Rambam writes all this. This is also in sync. I just brought a couple of examples. This is something that's mentioned in Kolbos Halavavos that the unification of God is one of the most fundamental parts of religion. He writes that it v'chud yipared hamami min hakofer rosh amitat hadad. That belief in the unification of God separates a believer from the heretic, and this is the chief axiom of the religion. Right. So all this is based on very normative medieval Jewish philosophy, etc. And I even brought in source 8. I brought the example of the Chaye Adam. Chaye Adam was a halachic sefer that was contemporary to. Somewhat contemporary to Imre Shafer, written by I believe he was a student of the Vilna Gaon. He lived in Vilna. So a lot of halachic works don't actually discuss belief so much, but the Chaye Adam does. But there were three fundamental things that you have to believe: that there's one God, that there's nothing. You know, in addition to God, that God is unified. There's no parts to God. So everything that Homburg is saying seems to really be in harmony with in terms of very fundamental parts of faith and belief in God. Really seems to be in sync with what any other normal sefer would say. Look on page 4. Homburg discusses revelation of the Torah as an ikar. So he says, "Ha'ikar shmini Hashem natan lanu Torahtenu haKedusha shebeidinu hayom al yedei Moshe b'chiro ne'eman beito." Okay, and again, this parallels the Rambam. Rambam, who talks about how the Torah that we have today is the same one that was given to Moshe. So really, the same thing here. What Homburg does that's interesting here. is that he gives the whole history of what led up to the revelation of the Torah, right? So he writes about Afgam biotam shubadim the paro melch mitzrayim lo shalchu nafsham lavoz v'kayon kasher yasu havadim ve'az galam Hashem me'avdo mitzrayim v'kervam lif neharsina v'diber ma'ham seret hadibro. So he gives a whole history of how we were slaves in Egypt, and then Hashem redeemed us and brought us to the Torah. So here, in explaining this as a fundamental faith, he's also able to insert a little bit of the history and the story, so that children understand what's behind this belief, and they get a little. Again, there's a goal here to really introduce a lot of fundamentals of Judaism. So even though talking about Yetziyah Mitzrayim and Hashem redeeming us is not perhaps necessary in affirming the belief in Torah Min HaShemayim, but it adds a little bit of flavor that gets that might help children sort of understand where this all comes from. It's just an opportunity to teach a story. What Homburg does not necessarily touch on, that the Rambam does. Rambam in this Ikar emphasizes the dangers of the heresy of not believing that the Torah came from a Kadosh Baruch Hu and what the parameters of that are. So Amr doesn't get so much into that into this discussion of heresy. I don't know if that was intentional or not. Maybe it wasn't necessary for children, but he certainly affirms this this Ikar. Homburg, so one of the other Ikarim that Homburg mentions here is reward and punishment. So he writes, this is source 11, Hu shokeb amos neit tzedek ho ma'asim v'siba tam notein schar va'onish b'mida yishara mavdil heita ben achote b'mnei shedacha ka alaf ashao ben achote mishri v'leif. So he talks about reward and punishment. I think it's interesting here, he talks about the difference between sin because we're human and we mess up versus somebody who intentionally sins. He ends up writing, so in order to prevent one from sinning, so one needs to follow the golden mean, which we talked a little bit yesterday during Mincha about in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the importance of not taking extreme in terms of character traits. So this is something that's obviously based very much on the Rambam, who wrote about the importance of not being an extremist in the sort of character traits that we develop. But Homburg brings us here to emphasize that helps one stay away from sin. But it's interesting to see this very strong influence of the Rambam. Which perhaps is significant because Homburg might feel very at home with the Rambam because the Rambam affirmed a little bit of a connection with culture and learning from others, and that's perhaps a not so hidden part of the agenda here is that the whole reason for this book is because of integration with society. So Rambam is a very natural place to turn, both for the thoroughness and expansiveness of what the Rambam has to offer in both philosophy and halacha, but also perhaps there's that cultural element. Turn page 5. Homburg discusses a little bit about the Messianic era. So that's the 12th principle in the Rambam. So it's very interesting. Most of the other Ikarim really have a very expansive discussion. In Imre Shefer, the discussion of the Mashiach here really only has one paragraph. It's very short. So I was thinking if there was something perhaps intentional about that maybe he wanted to shy away from discussing that too much. But in some ways, he's in good company with the Rambam there, because even the Rambam also writes in Hilchot Malachim in the Mishnah Torah that the only difference between Yemot HaMashiach, the days of the Messianic days, and this world is that we just won't be subjugated to other kingdoms. And then he writes, V'chol Elu Hadvarim V'chayotze Behen Lo Person's not going to know until they know. And these are things that most of us don't know. So Rambam discourages anybody from delving into it too much. So it could be that Hamburg also felt like, you know, it's important to mention Mashiach, but there's not so much to say about it because we don't really know. We don't really know what it's going to be, when it's going to come. But I thought it was fascinating that he doesn't get into it. Okay, so that's a lot of what he just says in terms of the fundamentals of faith. He affirms the importance of chinuch as something that's very important. He talks about that in the fundamentals of Jewish religion, and he talks about different ways that one can educate. So he says, source 15, "Min minhag ha'olam haben shalot aviv b'choy shehu ra'eh chaluf v'shinu b'anagato oim eino yodea tam dvarav v'misotav alav." That children naturally ask. Children naturally ask when they see something and they don't understand it, or if it diverts from what they're used to. So lama ta'aseken, right? So children are going to ask that question. So he says that it's incumbent upon a father to be able to properly respond to these comments. So he says im chacham ha'av yaskil gamet b'no v'yir enough. So If the father is knowledgeable, so he should explain the reasons to the children. But if one doesn't know, so one shouldn't mislead and lead his son astray. Right, it says v'chena dar b'afkol kol ish yarei Hashem chanech banav alecha b'drachav v'isharim v'ishnan. It's important to teach your reasons for the mitzvot so that the children appreciate. The more that children understand the reasons, then the more they'll want to walk in the path of religion. So Hamburg, he affirms the importance of education. Certainly wants, again, with the backdrop of, was he such a radical, he's definitely advocating here the importance of children staying on the proper path, but he affirms here that tamei hamitzvot, understanding the reasons behind the mitzvot, might help a child stay connected, but a lot of this is dependent on the father being able to explain it. And that's what he's in the next verse also. Yesh ba mitzvah asra rabot she'en shekol she'en seichol adam mechayvein ve'en da'at ha'adam asagel limtzot tamam min kol zeh chov lishmor v'asot otam b'vchina otam mitzvah v'gozer shehu hakadosh v'nizkav. When there's not a reason that's apparent, so it still remains an obligation. So that's something that's also important to affirm. So he affirms the importance of tamei ha-mitzvot, but also understanding that that's not always possible to explain it. Hamburg talks a little bit about tefillah, because that's, of course, very fundamental to Jewish religion. Just thought it was interesting to know here, again, that he really, he almost verbatim quotes the Rambam, so we can see a large Rambam influence on the Sefer. So that's a lot of what he discusses. Again, fundamentals, Yugimo Ikarim, things, tefillah is one example that of a mitzvah he talks about, but he talks about different mitzvot, importance of understanding mitzvot. So then he concludes this section by noting that the Ten Commandments are divided between Bein Adam L'Chaver, Bein Adam L'Makom. So here he notes that. And this is true about life in general, that Bein Adam L'Chaver is a very important part of the religion, and he notes at the bottom here, Shaniti Ad Havar Zeh Bavur Ra'iti Sheyesh Bnei Adam Hatzamim Bochim Marbim Betchina V'Tfila V'Tfilatam Kofim Kigmon Rasham V'Ulam Etachamas V'Gezal Lo Yachikul Me'Alehem. Bethlehem, that you have people who look like they're very pious and they daven and they're beating their chest when they daven, but they don't stay away from stealing and from harming others, and that's something that Humbert feels very strongly about. That on the one hand, here he talks about the importance of Jewish belief and Jewish practice. But at the same time, he hits very hard when it comes to Benam Lefavero. He really emphasizes that a lot. So with the remaining time, just want to discuss the Musar part of the book, because there's two parts. There's a religion, and then there's a Musar. And I mentioned that in some ways, the Musar part might seem like a normal work of Musar, but there are things about it, both in the details and some things that he adds that would not be so typical. So if we take three traits, if we take things like ava, pride, kas, anger, or atzlus, laziness. So if you look at a sefer like Orchot Tzadikim, which is what it did. So these are all traits that get discussed. It works on Musar, things that are important. So there's a lot of overlap in what Imre Sheffer discusses and what Sefer like Orchot Tzadikim would discuss, but there's a little bit, there's a very interesting difference in the way Imre Sheffer discusses it. Because Imre Sheffer, when it comes to, for example, pride, so when it comes to Orchot Tzadikim, so he just talks about why it's a bad character trait, why it's bad for one's connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that if you have too much pride, then you don't. Then you forget a Kaddish Baruch Hu, and you'll care less about mitzvot. Imre Sheffer talks about the problem of pride in the context of society. Source 19 in the second paragraph, he says, "Shekavanata bori he sheyu bnei adam bishuva v'chavura nezarim zem mizeh. Kemet zachoch matonis kaval chonin me'abim bnei adam b'malod yoter nichbado v'lo l'tar eler atan ala tovan ha'chaver." So why is pride bad? It's not just because of forgetting a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but it's also because then you're not going to be interested in assisting other people and working to cooperatively with other people. Okay. Likewise, when it comes to anger, so anger is a religiously problematic trait. We do things that we're not supposed to do when we're angry. And Imre Sheffer, he writes, "Derech ba'alei harili ba'telim lachdam ve'enam osimu uma kol hayom." That if you're an angry person, so you'll be you won't do your work. You'll be thinking about how to plot other people. And kolan she'ir as a state otem yisharush mamam ibli overotam. And so people are angry all the time, so their fields will just be empty and desolate because they won't be doing their work. So he thinks about a lot of these things. From again, we talked about the edict of tolerance. We talked about how the goal of tolerance and increasing Jewish secular education was to make them useful members of society. So Hamburg sort of runs with this, even talking about things that have already a Jewish element to them. In other Sefer Musar, he gives a little bit of societal spin. Right? When you take the example of laziness. So if you look at Orchot Tzadikim, the main problem with laziness is that a person won't learn Torah and they won't keep mitzvos. Nimer Sheffer, he says, "Nimsam mitzdarech al abriyot ubali de machzor vizayon v'acharishin enem igiyat acharim ibli sheyish lahem shum gbul tova v'tovalo mimenu." So, a person who's lazy ends up becoming dependent on other people, and that's bad for society. So, Humbert takes this a little bit of societal, I mean, which societal direction, which shouldn't make it problematic. I think it's actually quite interesting, but you do sort of see here that even though in some ways Imre Sheffer looks like a very traditional Jewish work, there is something that was a little bit innovative about it in the context of Jews becoming more integrated with society. The main place where this work of Musar really diverges is that he talks about obligations to the state. So in verse 22, it says, "Ru'u yedidai, look, my friends, ad hena lo limati etchem ki im Roshei chovot ha'adam el atzmo b'shmir ha'gufo mikol ma'achal ra v'kasha l'itakel b'nikiyuv l'amem l'achal parnes b'mena l'argyo atzmo b'mida nechona. So until now, I was just teaching you ways to take care of ourselves and to make sure our bodies are healthy and that we have what we need. So now we have to think about the relationship between different families and all the families together. Because all the families together comprise a city, and then you have, and then all the all the citizens of one city together come together to different cities, the whole state. So we also have not only personal obligations, but we have societal obligations. That's something that's quite innovative here. So that's something that he really emphasizes here, that a part of Jewish ethics is one's obligations to the state. Verse 23 says, why is this important? Because you can't have a society where without laws and without leaders and judges. So this is obviously very important. In source 7, he writes the importance of acting appropriately towards the judges and law enforcement figures and political figures. Don't think that this just applies to Jewish judges because of Dino de Machuta Dina, which we talked about earlier this past summer, right? Which means that any law that's imposed by society is applicable as long as it doesn't destroy fundamentals of Judaism and its faith, right? So obviously, Dina de Machuta Dina wouldn't apply if it was anti-Semitic or if it advocated the abolishment of Jewish religion. But otherwise, everyone's obligated, and he's saying this from a Jewish perspective. Everybody's obligated to be a law-abiding citizen. And he goes on about this in source 25. As we said, we have an obligation to be respectful to the judges of the king, just like the Jewish judges. Because if they act with justice, so then they provide a great benefit. They'll protect the vulnerable.
So here
he takes like a perspective, kind of like the Meiri. Many Rishonim assume that Christianity is avodah zarah, at least for Jews, that it's somewhat idolatrous. But here he sort of takes a cue from the Meiri that. If you're going to say, well, they're not Jewish and they're idolaters, so I don't really have to respect them. So Hamburg says, in fact, everybody, all of the political figures in our state are God fearing and believing individuals, and we should give them the proper respect, even though it's a different religion, but they're working for the good of society, and they are justice loving. Individuals. So he talks about the importance of having a vital, robust government, and that it's in the best interest of everybody to go along with that. You shouldn't just think that respect for the government applies to Jewish leaders, but really applies to everybody. He has very strong words for people who don't pay taxes in source 28. Have a lot of needs for society. You have to make coins. Tikkun adrachim. You have to fix the roads and the bridges. Tikkun beirot. You have to fix the wells. Let me ask you. How can you have hospitals and schools and fix the roads if people don't pay taxes? Where's all that money going to come from? It's still very relevant to today. And he continues on, source 29, since we've seen that the goal of the king is to do good with society, people that they just want to do the best for everybody, so everybody has to pay their taxes, and can't just be for fear of getting caught, because if you only pay taxes for fear of getting caught, then when you know you're not going to get caught, you're not going to do it. But you have to understand that this is morally necessary in order for a society to continue on. So it's very interesting. This is he's talking here to a Jewish audience, assumingly coming from a Jewish perspective, and even invokes halachic ideas such as dina de machud dina and the pasuk from Yirmiyahu, v'dir shu et shalom ha'ir, should seek the welfare of the city and pray for it. So he brings all this in to urge people to be law-abiding citizens and to contribute to society. So, with all this said, this work Imrei Shefer, which was written by Maskil, a disciple of Moses Mendelssohn, seems to be a mostly normal traditional work, especially towards the beginning. When he was talking about the fundamentals of Judaism, really all things that come from places like the Rambam, other medieval Rishonim, but really touch on most fundamental aspects of Jewish faith. Nothing that I saw that really diverges from anything that you would see in anything else normative. The Mirsad part also seems to parallel in many ways other normative Musar works that preceded it with, but with a little bit of an emphasis on being participants in society. Obviously, that was a message that he wanted to hit home with this increased integration. So why was Hamburg considered to be a little bit of a radical then? Somebody claimed that they saw Hamburg eating pork sausage, so he wasn't a real thing. But that that doesn't seem to be verified. So my professor with whom I developed these ideas with back in college said that that she thought that perhaps one person thought that Hamburg was a radical. So all other academics who pulled from that source just kind of assumed that Hamburg was a radical because they didn't necessarily read his stuff, but just kind of assumed based on what was previously written. It could be that his emphasis on paying taxes and cooperating with the government collecting taxes irked some in the Jewish community. Or it could be that perhaps the shortening of this into Bnei Tzion made it look like a more radical work. I don't know, but here it's interesting to see here that on the one hand we have Maskil who writes this book. It's fairly traditional in nature, but it does perhaps show to a little bit point to a little bit of integration with society, which I think for modern Orthodox Jews, I think it's something important to think about as we evaluate the Haskalah, that that there's maybe something we can learn from this in the way that this book sought to help us integrate into society. It could be that in Hakinami for a world that's really Torah only, so maybe there are parts of this book that would not seem to be necessarily so in line with not necessarily beliefs, but in terms of one's outlook in terms of integration with society and contribution to society. I think for us, there's actually like a lot to learn from this. As I was reading this over again, I felt like I was a little bit enriched in terms of how I think of my place in society. It was very interesting to see here how one person sort of balanced tradition, not even with Western ideas or philosophy per se, but really just with the need to adjust to a new political reality and urging people to be cooperative members of society. Okay, have a good day.